You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm David Ignatius, a columnist at the Post. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Dmitry Alperovich, the co-founder of the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, co-founder of a new think tank called Silverado Policy Accelerator, and now co-author of a new book titled World on the Brink: How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. Dmitry, welcome back to Washington Post Live.
So good to be with you, David.
So we'll talk about your book in detail, but I want to begin with one issue that is perhaps central to starting the process of deterring China. And that's the step that Congress just took in passing legislation that would force TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to sell that very popular social media app or be banned in the United States. I'm curious whether you think that's good legislation and what difference you think it will make in the larger picture of U.S.-Chinese relations.
It's a great question. You know, David, I don't talk about TikTok in the book, even though I do think that having a major influence, essentially a media company operating in the United States like this that is controlled by an adversary is a problem. But I do support the legislation because I do think that we have to have rules of the road here. And for one, we don't have reciprocity where American apps like Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, of course, not allowed in China. So on that basis alone, I would not let Chinese in our country because we want fair trade. We want a fair relationship. And right now it's very one-sided. But beyond that, we actually have foreign media ownership rules in this country where if you're a foreign citizen, for example, you cannot buy a national TV network. Rupert Murdoch famously had this issue in the 1980s when he was trying to buy the Fox network and was prevented from doing so until he became an American citizen. Well, here you have a company that is effectively under the influence and some say control of the Chinese Communist Party that is allowed to have influence over 50% of the American public. So I do think that we either ban it or we force a divestiture.
So Dmitry, you're one of the technology analysts I trust the most. I'm just curious whether you think that Chinese ownership of TikTok gives them fundamental national security leverage, a kind of on-off switch if we ever came to a crisis, as some people have argued.
I don't. I think that threat is a little bit overblown. Again, for me, this is much more of an issue of fairness and ability for them to influence the American public, not just to influence them in terms of what we see, but also what we don't see. I can tell you, a good friend of mine was telling me about his experience watching some videos from the Ukrainians and their war on TikTok, and he came back to one of the videos where they were showing destruction of Russian military equipment, and it suddenly disappeared. And he didn't know if it disappeared because the person that uploaded it pulled it off, whether it was a violation of terms of service or whether the algorithm or more likely a moderator decided to take it off because it wasn't portraying Russia in a good light. And the problem is we don't know, right? When these things occur, we don't know who is in control, and that's a problem.
So staying with topics in the news, Secretary of State Blinken just returned from a trip to China where he met with President Xi Jinping. The meeting seemed to be unusually frosty. The Chinese didn't even show up at the airport to say goodbye to Blinken, which is pretty unusual. This comes after a period where there'd been what looked like some improvement in the U.S.-China relationship. What's your judgment? Is it a good thing or a bad thing that the relationship is as frosty as it is? Would you like to see better dialogue, or do you think we're really fated not to be friends for now?
Well, whether it's good or bad, I just think it's the reality. I never believed that this rapprochement that began last summer, that I think was very tactical on both sides, was ever going to last. For the Chinese, they were, of course, looking at a really terrible situation with their economy, 15% unemployment, stagnating growth, and more importantly, foreign direct investment leaving the country, 20% year-over-year decline, as we just learned back in February. And they've been trying to attract business back into the country, so it was important for them to project this era of stability in the U.S. relationship. I think the Biden administration facing with a war in Ukraine, conflict in the Middle East, the crisis. So there was a temporary desire on both sides to come to terms. But the reason I never thought it would last is because the Chinese, I think we're quite naive in thinking that, a few summits, a summit with Biden back in San Francisco and some conversations with Blinken would fundamentally turn the opinion of American businesses would return and reinvest into China. That hasn't happened. The export controls and other policies of the Biden administration have not ended. And that's why I think the Chinese are now reacting the way they are, that they realized that the trajectory of the relationship is heading one way and it's not in a positive direction.
So one issue that Blinken stressed during his visit was the United States' desire that China not increase and in fact reduce its support for Russia in its war in Ukraine. I'm curious whether you think that for Xi, there may be a breaking point, a moment where he decides that support for Russia in what's becoming a very long war just isn't in China's interest. What do you think?
I don't. And look, I actually think that for one, a long war in Europe is actually in China's interest. Now, I don't think they caused it. I don't think that they were looking forward to it. But now that it's happening, and the fact that it is A, weakening Russia and pulling Western businesses out of Russia, which allows Chinese companies to come in and quite on the cheap get a lot of that. We lost the connection. I don't know. Connection.
We're still hearing you.
I lost for a second. Okay, good. The fact that the Chinese businesses are able to come in and take a lot of their market share, the fact that China is able to buy oil on the cheap and gas on the cheap from Russia is a positive for them. And it keeps the United States distracted. Of course, U.S. is spending a lot of its military munitions by sending them to Ukraine. So I don't think that China is particularly interested in any of that conflict. I think they're also realistic about the limited leverage they have, and to the extent that they have any, they're not willing to expand it.
Let's talk about your piece in the Washington Post this morning, and congratulations on being a Washington Post author. I don't think that's the summit of your career, but it's very nice to have you. So you write about China, Taiwan, and the crucial semiconductor industry. I'm going to quote briefly from the piece. You say, any U.S. strategy to avoid losing global influence and power to China requires ensuring that China neither achieves a tipping point of domestic independence and means of production of semiconductors, nor seizes Taiwan and its valuable fabricating plants, fabs. You talk about a four-pronged approach to try to achieve that goal of deterrence. Lay out just briefly for folks who may not have seen the Washington Post yet, what your argument is, and tell us how you think the United States is doing in achieving the kind of protection, deterrence of Chinese takeover of Taiwanese semiconductor capacity.
Yeah, first of all, let me say, David, that this is not a chips book. There's a little bit of details in the book on the chips, but and I do not believe that the only way to deter China is through chips policy. But I think it can contribute. Certainly, you need a military deterrence. You need a broader economic deterrence strategy. But because chips are so vital to the modern economy, they often are called the new oil. I actually think that's a misnomer because there are, of course, alternatives to oil, non-fossil fuels, et cetera. There is no alternative to semiconductors. You can't build any modern electronics without them. And because of that, you want to use the semiconductor industry that is still largely controlled by the West to exert more leverage over China that can help you make the case, the deterrence case, against moving on Taiwan. And the four-pronged approach that I lay out in the piece is essentially this. First of all, you want to deny China the ability to achieve chip breakout capability, effectively produce their own chips. The Biden administration, I think, has done a pretty good job of doing that on the advanced chips, essentially chips that are below 20 nanometers. But the so-called foundational chips, which are in everything, in every modern piece of electronics, weapon systems, microwaves, cars, the chips that are above 20 nanometers, China is about to achieve dominance. And the way they're achieving that dominance is by buying Western equipment that you need to manufacture those chips. China, by and large, does not have a domestic industry. They have not been able to figure out how to build the most sophisticated equipment that man has ever built, the equipment that you need to build these semiconductors. And by banning the export of that equipment to China at every node level, we can A, prevent them from producing their own chips, make them more dependent on chips from Taiwan, from US, Japan, and other places. Two, we should tell them that in the case of an invasion of Taiwan, we should probably tell them that they will not get those fabs. We can basically work with the Taiwanese to either disable them in the case of them losing a potential war. We could even institute a ban of export of equipment and precursor chemicals and the like that would make those labs effectively inoperable. So if they can't produce their own chips, if Taiwan is not an answer to their chips problem, and three, if we tell them that we will actually ban the import, the export of chips to China in the case of an invasion, like we, by the way, did with Russia, that would have a devastating impact on their own economy. Because, of course, while Russia has been able to manage by buying chips on the black market, largely from China, there is no China to rescue China. And the amount of chips that they need is, you know, 1,000 times greater than what Russia needs, and there's simply not enough black market semiconductors to rescue them from that perspective. So it's a great way to tell them that we will have leverage over your economy, and we can cause you enormous pain if you try to move for Taiwan. It's not sufficient for deterrence in its own right, but it's really important. And the last piece is really to reduce the pain that they would cause to us in encouraging divestments from that region, both from China and Taiwan. And to that extent, we've passed, of course, the CHIPS Act that invested in domestic production and actually encouraged a chips race, where many of our allies in Europe and Singapore and other places have invested in their own chips production as well in order to keep up with us. And that's all great, because the more chips are being produced outside of that region, that potential conflict region, the better.
So let me just ask a mildly contrarian question. What would you say to people who remember pre-World War II history and who would argue that American attempts to deny Japan resources essential for its rise helped trigger the cycle that eventually led to Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and their involvement in World War II? There is a danger, isn't there, in trying to deny an adversary what is an essential raw material of growth?
Well, I want to quibble with you there, David, because, of course, Japanese expansions in Asia did not begin with the U.S. blockade of oil to Japan. They started the war with China in the 1930s. They expanded across that entire region long before Pearl Harbor. So the ambition to kick the U.S. out of that region existed long before that embargo. And the same situation plays out with China, that China has wanted to take Taiwan since 1949, as I write in the book. They see this as unfinished business from the Civil War. They never truly defeated the Chiang Kai-shek nationalists, because they were, of course, able to flee the mainland and come over to Taiwan and establish a rival China, a Republic of China, as the country is now called. And taking Taiwan does not only have this historical element, even though Taiwan never actually belonged to China, as I write in the book, but Xi Jinping believes that it does, but it also has that destiny element to it, where this would be the ultimate victory in the finishing of the Civil War, and for Xi Jinping personally to accomplish something that Mao could not, of course, achieve in his lifetime. So the reasons for China trying to take Taiwan have nothing to do with the United States and have everything to do with his own ego, view of history and security and geography of that region from China's perspective, where they feel themselves surrounded and contained by U.S. allies from Korea to Japan to the Philippines and of course, Taiwan. So I don't think that actions we're going to take are more likely to trigger war, because I think war, they're on a path to war. In fact, as we know from CIA Director Burns, he's given the order to his military to be ready by 2027. All of these actions would be attempts to increase leverage and potentially deter conflict. And lastly, I'm not arguing to deny them chips. which they need to sustain their economy. What I'm saying is we should deny them the ability to produce chips so that they can keep buying it from us.
So let's turn to the book. As an author myself, I want to make sure that people see a copy of it. And I've enjoyed reading it. So you open with a very vivid hypothetical attack on Taiwan in November 2028. You say it would be unlike anything the military, U.S. military, has experienced since World War II. And you end that opening with a haunting question of what would the president do in that situation. The essential point, as I read it of your book, is that we are at a critical inflection point. The title of your book says it all, where the world is at on the brink. So I want to ask you to go to the heart of the argument in this book and talk for us a bit about how you help a future president avoid that hideous moment where he's got to decide between a devastating war and what would amount to capitulation. Just explain to us how we avoid that situation somewhere down the road.
Absolutely. Well, as I write in the book, we're in a Cold War, and Taiwan plays the same role that West Berlin played for much of the first Cold War, where for the first 15 years, we almost went to war with the Soviet Union on multiple occasions, starting in the 1940s with the attempted blockade of West Berlin and continuing to 1961. With Kennedy and Khrushchev meeting in Vienna, and Khrushchev coming away convinced that Khrushchev was going to invade West Berlin, and Kennedy famously going on television to warn the American public to prepare for war, including nuclear war, and authorizing Congress to build bunkers to sustain a nuclear assault. Very, very dangerous time. However, in August of 1961, Kennedy is woken up and he's told that the East Germans have begun building the Berlin Wall, and he celebrates. He celebrates, right? 20 years later, President Reagan says, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." But at that moment, Kennedy celebrates because he says, if they're building the wall, they're not invading. And following the building of the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis, which happened a year later, but was really an outcome of the Berlin crisis, you have a stabilization relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. You have detente in the 1970s, improved relations, later even under Reagan, the Gorbachev summits and the like. So even though the Cold War continued, the risk that these two superpowers would go to war diminished dramatically following the end of that conflict. And as I argue in the book, if we manage to deter Chinese invasion of Taiwan, the Cold War will not go away. This global competition for supremacy will remain with us. But there's no chance that we would go to war with China over some rocks in South China Sea or this World War II era ship, Sierra Madre, that the Philippines have ground on this disputed territory. None. But Taiwan is that conflict place where you could have a potentially devastating war. And there are really only three possibilities here. Possibility one is that we deter China from ever undertaking this invasion, the Goldilocks scenario, they never try. Or possibilities two and three, where they go for it and they win or lose. And I argue that, obviously, it's always better to win, but those scenarios are just going to be absolutely devastating. Global economy will go into immediate depression, $10 trillion of value estimated to be wiped out in the first year, not to mention the unbelievable loss of life, unlike anything that Americans, if we fight, have experienced since World War II, and potentially even eclipsing that in terms of daily casualties. So we have to avoid that scenario at all costs. We have to make sure that he's waking up, she is waking up every single day. And as he looks at himself in the mirror in the morning, he says, today is not the day. And the book is really the strategy for how we get there.
So that's a good image of she telling himself, today is not the day. You talk in your book about winning. I just quote a brief passage. We need to focus on one thing, winning the peace, winning economic competition, winning the technological race, winning allies. Just again, a cautionary note. I grew up in the Cold War years, as you did in Russia. I remember this phrase, peaceful coexistence, this idea that we were in a long struggle, that winning wasn't the issue so much as persisting, as showing continuity, strength, but peaceful coexistence along the way was in our interest as a country. Why isn't that a good rule for Cold War II, which, as you say, we're facing now?
Again, David, I would quibble with you because certainly we wanted peace back then, we want peace now, but we were not thinking that we would lose to the Soviet Union, the technological race, the economic race, the ideological race, that we would just allow communism to spread across the world, right? We were focused very much on winning. Now, we also wanted to avoid a nuclear conflict, absolutely, as we do today, but we did not want to surrender any more countries to fall under the Soviet influence. We fought it both covertly and overtly in many cases, not always smartly, of course. We made mistakes like Vietnam and interventions in Iran and Central America and others that I think were very ill-advised. But we were intently focused on winning, and we ultimately won, right? The objective throughout the Cold War was outlasting the Soviet Union, realizing what George Kennan outlined post-World War II, that the Soviet Union was this unnatural phenomenon that would one day collapse. Now, winning in this conflict is very different because, unlike the Soviet Union, China is not going anywhere, right? It's been around for 5,000 years. It'll be around for thousands of years more, if not longer. And the Communist Party may also survive a lot longer than we think. There are some people in this town that think that we should be engaging in regime change. I'm not of that view. I think there's absolutely nothing we can do to influence the control that the CCP has over China. It is ultimately to the Chinese people to figure out what system of government that they want. So if you define winning as CCP fallen, you may be waiting a very, very long time for that. But I do think that if we win, if we A, deter Taiwan, and B, if we manage to win the technological race for the 21st century in four critical technology areas that I talk about, AI and autonomy, biotech and synthetic biology, space technology, and the so-called green technology or the next generation energy, clean energy, we can absolutely win the economic race and thus the national security race, because if we remain the greatest economy on the planet as we are today, it will enable us to spend sufficient resources on military systems, defense industrial procurement, and the like to ensure that we continue to have the national security that we need and protect the world's trade routes for American consumers and American businesses.
We have a provocative question from a member of our audience about what it would take for the U.S. to directly engage China militarily. Roxanne Sanchez from Arizona asks, what would be the red line for the U.S. with China? What's your answer to that, Dmitry?
You know, I've done a lot of war games on this conflict, and, you know, one of the most challenging issues for any president, of course, the most challenging issue is, do you even fight? And you have President Biden on four occasions separately saying that he would fight for Taiwan, even though that is not U.S. policy. We remain with a policy of ambiguity on that issue. But if you do decide to fight, you know, one of the things that the Pentagon will undoubtedly want is to hit air bases and missile bases on the Chinese mainland that could have a devastating effect on the U.S. Navy in the region, U.S. assets in Guam, in Okinawa, and elsewhere. And if you can neutralize those air bases and missile bases, it will give U.S. an enormous advantage. But if you do that, if you hit the Chinese mainland, you should expect that the U.S. mainland will get hit, and ballistic missiles from China will be flying into San Diego and Seattle and other areas across the United States, hopefully military, not civilian, hopefully conventional, not nuclear. But, you know, once you have those types of missile exchanges, who knows where it leads to? So, you know, the conflict with China is not just a devastating conflict in the region, but it would be very difficult to contain it to just that region and not have it spread, including to mainland the United States. And also, it will be very difficult to keep it conventional because you have two nuclear powers going to a hot conflict. Again, you hope that cooler heads will prevail and it would not deteriorate, but the risks are so huge here, which is why, again, the focus needs to be on deterrence. And the problem with deterrence is that it's ultimately unmeasurable, right? We don't know what it would take to affect the decision-making of one person, and it is one person, Xi Jinping, who would make that decision. And when we've confronted that dilemma in other areas, particularly in the nuclear realm, we decided to go for overkill, right? If you look, for example, at our nuclear response capabilities, we said it's not enough to have hundreds of nuclear-tipped missiles and silos across the United States. We also want to have submarine-launched weapons. We want to have against them. And
so, Dimitri, we're breaking up a little bit. Forgive me, Dimitri's line is momentarily cut off. I'm going to just
sorry, did I lose you?
So let me ask another question. Let me see if we get the answer through. So I want to talk a little bit about Ukraine and China. Elbridge Colby, who's one of the most prominent analysts of China, may serve in a Trump administration if Trump should be elected, has argued often that the Ukraine war in many ways is a distraction from what we should really be focusing on, which is the conflict with China. I'm curious whether you share any of that view, whether you think we're overdoing it on Ukraine.
So look, I think there's a nuanced position here where, let me be very clear, I'm fully in support of Ukraine. I think we should be providing aid to Ukraine. I don't think we should let Russia win in that conflict. But having said that, I think that Bridge and others make a good argument that some of the provisions of aid that we send to Ukraine are impacting our stockpiles, unquestionably, and our readiness in the Indo-Pacific. I think it's a small portion of that aid. I have no problems providing Ukraine with massive amounts of armored vehicles, artillery, munitions, howitzers, and tanks, and those sorts of things, because frankly, a lot of those systems are not applicable to the fight over the Pacific. But in certain areas, particularly missiles and air defense systems, we are dangerously low, not just because of Ukraine, but also because of the actions we're now taking in the Middle East. And we have to be concerned that if I'm right, and the timeline for this potential conflict is 4 years away, that is not enough time to build up our inventories in sufficient numbers to be able to defend against what is the largest missile and rocket force on the planet, that is of the People's Republic of China. So we have to be thoughtful about what we spend and how we spend it. Again, we should provide Ukraine with everything possible that we can, but things that would not endanger our ability to deter a conflict over Taiwan.
We have just barely 2 minutes left, I'm afraid. I want to ask you one last question that goes back to what I mentioned at the outset of our program. You are one of the world's leading cybersecurity experts, familiar with attempts to disrupt our elections using cyber warfare. I want to ask you what you're expecting in the 2024 elections from Russia and China in terms of interference in our election process. What should people be on the lookout for?
Look, I think it's become normalized now with every election, you're going to have influence operations, not just from China and Russia, but from Iran, maybe even North Korea in the future. You're going to have social media disinformation. You're going to attempt to do influence operations potentially by targeting voters directly, as we've seen in the past, in 2020, for example, from Iran. So that has just become par for the course. But look, you know, I think our society is a lot more resilient to that. I'm not one of those people that is incredibly concerned about those influence operations having an effect on the American public. I think most people, particularly in this election, have made up their mind who they're going to vote for. And I doubt that influence operations from China or anywhere else are going to affect that decision at this point.
So this has been a fascinating conversation. I wish we had another half hour. You can see why this book is called World on the Brink from our conversation. These are scary topics, but really important ones. Dimitri Alperovich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.